What's that?
Requiring us to change our regulators, our boards, and that was my feedback on this. How do we meet that challenge? And how do we bring in massive amounts of mobile storage and stationary? Also, it's a in a pretty short time.
I love Tavares capturing all the drama.
Yeah,
I
have a problem.
There are any other
things.
I
think
digestible by the front
So figuring out and that's where the big opportunity is. Maybe that will be the
Oh, yeah. Sorry?
We're okay.
I put in work for you. How can I come into a
new school? I'll just shut up. It's not charged. Thanks for trying.
Yeah.
Adjourn and reconvene at the board retreat. Did I understand it?
That's correct.
So there are some alternates in the audience, and if your member's not here, you just ascended to this table. If your member's here, stay there. Everybody's here, I guess, with the alternates. So some cities participate more than others, which I guess we're seeing. Thank you. Do we have the roll call, please?
Alden, here. Berkeley?
Here.
Dublin?
Here.
Do you mind Emeryville? Fremont?
Here.
Hayward?
Here.
Livermore?
Here.
Oakland?
Here.
Piedmont?
Here.
San Diego?
Here.
Union City, Community Advisory Committee,
here,
and Alameda County.
Oh, here. All right, Pledge of Allegiance led by Mr. Mandel. It's in the back corner.
Please rise. You're going to join us? And begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Close the comment. It's time in which you can speak to anything that is not on today's agenda. Barbara, you were in first, then Jessica Tovar.
So East Bay Clean Power Alliance is working on a proposal to propose an increase in the local development business plan budget. Probably no surprise to people who know about our advocacy. But the Community Advisory Committee meeting on Monday, there was a very interesting discussion about the possibility of moving local development, which is currently a line item, under the overhead operations as a line item under energy operations, because actually the local development business plan should impact energy operations, especially once we have a significant amount of local development, but even if there's a little amount. If we did that, what it would mean is that items like the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative that will include a lot of local renewable energy resources would then be counted as part of that local development. Or not the whole thing, but cost over what the cost of market purchased energy would be, that would then be part of a local development line item. So given that, we think that's actually a really smart idea, and what really should be done with the local development business plan, as well as other local development energy, renewable, clean energy projects, should all be under that line item, under energy operations, and there would need to be some breakdown of that budget. So the local development business plan projects would have kind of a separate budget that is then implemented by J.P. Ross. So that is kind of the outline of what our proposal will be. I'm telling you now, you'll get a written one well before June 19th. Thank you.
Jessica.
Yeah. So I was asked by Susan Stefferson of California Interfaith Power and Light to invite any board members, staff of East Bay Community Energy. There's an event tomorrow by the League of Conservation Voters of the East Bay. They are honoring Local Clean Energy Alliance and East Bay Clean Power Alliance for the work and advocacy we've done with East Bay Community Energy. And they're really interested in having some of you all attend tomorrow evening. It's from 6 to 8 at the Port Bar in Oakland. You can let me know if you're interested in going. I can put you on the guest list. Otherwise, feel free to pay $75 or more to get in. Thanks.
I looked on my calendar, but I have a conflict. But when they sent out the notice, I checked and I have a conflict. So, anybody else in a public comment? Can I get approval of the minutes for May 15th?
I'll move the approval of the minutes for May 15th.
I have a motion and a second. Hernandez. Any objection to the motion? I've been wanting to do that.
And we're not married.
Do tell. Any objection to the motion? Motion passed, all objection. Item 5, amendment to our legal services. That's you.
Yeah, so item 5 is an amendment to our legal services.
What, you checked the score?
Yeah. I was looking at my chips. Item 5 is an amendment to our legal services to add some additional funds to a contract that we have with Davis Wright Tremaine. Davis Wright Tremaine has predominantly been providing regulatory services to us, in addition to supporting some general work that we're doing with the California Public Utilities Commission related to RPS and resource adequacy and finance, compliance findings. And that is on the consent agenda, though.
Oh, yeah. Is it? Oh, yeah.
That's why you
look at me. I didn't see consent.
Yeah,
look at that. So, listen, why don't we just not do the minutes? Okay, wait a minute. Let me fix this. Hernandez, are you willing to move item 4 and 5?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the consent calendar. So I'm going back and revoting on the approval of it. So is there any objections to item 4 and 5? Seeing none, motion passes with those in attendance. Item 6. See what happens when you give me a little Mexican code? All right, go ahead.
Item 6, we're seeking board approval for 2 long-term contracts. These are our first 2 long-term 10-year or longer contracts that we're seeking approval for. And both of these contracts are a result of our 2 RFP processes. We have a brief presentation prepared. I'll start with a quick introduction and overview of the 2 projects, the 2 contracts associated with them. Provide a little bit more background and overview on the RFP process itself, that was a better process that awarded me. And then go back to the projects and provide a little bit more detail on those for counterparties as well as the contracts themselves. So by way of introduction, the 2 contracts we're looking at here are the 10-year, 20-megawatt local Greater Bay Area Resource Adequacy Contract. That is a contract that is with Vistra Energy as the project developer and owner. This is a contract that's been awarded through our Open Clean Energy Initiative RFP. It is expected to start delivering local RA in January of 2022 for a period of 10 years. The contracting entity under Vistra is Dynegy Marketing and Trade LLC. The second contract is a 15-year, approximately 55-megawatt solar PV power purchase agreement with Solar Frontier Americas. This project was awarded out of the California Renewable Energy RFP and is expected to be operational in December of 2021, and is a contract for all energy, RECs, RA, really all associated products from this particular solar project. It's for a period of 15 years with a hub settled pricing, which is the hub is PG&E-DLAB. And the contracting entity, Solar Frontier, is the developer. The actual project company, the other contract is called Polari Solar Center LLC. The RFPs that we ran as part of the award process or review process here really had two objectives. Looking to create an open and competitive solicitation to seek projects based in California. One was to contract a significant percentage of our SB 350 requirements, which is the long-term renewable energy contracting requirement, so that's 65% of our RPS requirements. And then the other objective was really to seek RA, resource adequacy, as part of our Open Clean Energy Initiative contract. Of course, underlying those product solicitations are to drive California and Alameda County job creation and community investment. The actions we took were we issued those two RFPs. Those RFPs, again, were called the Open Clean Energy Initiative. This was a pretty unique RFP, the first of its kind, which was a joint RFP issued with PG&E, whereby we sought resource adequacy and PG&E sought reliability. Really, the intent there was to look for virtual transmission solutions that could meet the reliability needs that are currently served by a downtown Oakland peaker plant that's run off of fossil fuel. That's a project that's owned by Dynegy. And so this OCI initiative was issued in order to seek products that could help shut down that particular peaker plant. Our minimum target as part of the RFP, PBC's minimum target was 20 megawatts of local resource adequacy. The other RFP is the California Renewable Energy RFP. This was EBC's first long-term renewable energy solicitation. It was issued about a year ago in June of 2018, so it's been quite a lengthy process. That was looking specifically at California-located projects with a strong preference for new builds. In that RFP, we were seeking a minimum target of 20 megawatts within Alameda County. And we were fortunate to see a pretty robust response to that with over 550 unique offers representing about 75 different projects. I'll touch a little bit on the evaluation methodology. Given the volumes that I just spoke to, there were a lot of counterparties, a lot of proposals that we looked at. So some key criteria that we focused on, of course, were the economic and financial risks associated with that particular project, thinking about where it was delivering. We talked about the sort of concept of P-node and some of the risks associated with pricing at a particular P-node. So we took that into account, looking at sort of the fixed and floating pricing structures, the contract duration, and of course region. Looked a lot at project development risk, so wanted to award a portfolio of projects that represented both more mature projects that could deliver in the near term, as well as projects that were priced very effectively, and oftentimes those were projects that were a little further away and had a little bit more development risk associated with those. Part of that assessment, we looked at site control, interconnection, permitting status, in order to evaluate that. We looked heavily at project location and, of course, community investments. So, as I noted already, there was a minimum target of 20 megawatts within Alameda County for the California RFP, and then for the Clean Energy Initiative, of course, it's entirely based. As part of the non-Alameda County-based projects, we did negotiate community investments, and that's something that's pretty unique in the market, so we're pretty excited to say that we were successful in having counterparties committed to that. And then last couple points here, workforce development was, of course, an important focus as well as part of the RFP. So within RFP, all of our contracts, we're looking at prevailing wage and union labor as part of that. And then lastly, of course, experience from counterparties, experience both developing projects and financing projects, and the size and scale of these units. So I'll move on to the specific projects that we're talking about now and the counterparties themselves, starting with the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative. Vistra Energy is a large integrated power company based in Irving, Texas. They operate in 12 states, have over 6,000 employees, so a very large organization. They're a double B-rated entity. They're the current owner of the Dynegy peaker plant that's in downtown Oakland. As part of this contracting process, we felt that it was critical to work with Vistra because they do own and operate the existing peaker plant that we're looking to close as part of this initiative. They play a critical role in actually negotiating the transition from that peaker plant to a clean energy solution here. And the reason is because the RMR reliability must run contract that exists, which requires that plant to continue operating. And so our award here is in part due to the confidence that we have that Vistra, as the owner of that project, will be able to best manage the transition away from that RMR contract, and of course replace the existing site with clean energy storage solutions. Lastly, there is that Vistra has used union labor there as part of their O&M operations, and is heavily committed to using labor for both construction and O&M for the new storage site as well. So a little bit more detail on the particular project. It's a 20 megawatt project with a 4-hour duration, so 80 megawatt hours. Again, it's delivering specifically for the local Greater Bay Area resource adequacy. Expected to start delivering in January of 2022. This particular project is delivering to the Oakland Substation C. As part of the RFP, there was two very specific load pockets that we were targeting, and so that was a critical part of this, of course, which really narrows the sort of field of potential projects that can actually provide some transmission support given that downtown area. They're anticipating using Tier 1 lithium-ion batteries for application. And the other benefit, of course, working with Vistra, where they have an existing project already, is the permitting, the interconnection and related risks are heavily mitigated because there's something that's operating to deliver energy to that location today. The next project I'll focus on is the one with Solar Frontier Americas. Solar Frontier Americas is a development shop that's the U.S. division is based out of San Francisco. They are a subsidiary of a Japanese company. Their sister company is the largest, one of the largest thin film solar energy producers, manufacturers in the world. They're an experienced developer here in California, have recently worked with another CCA, the Minnesota Clean Energy, in acquiring a project there, and so are actively financing that project and in construction on it. They have a large market capitalization of nearly $5 billion. And so are an investment grade entity. The project itself is a 55 megawatt AC solar project located in Tulare County. As I noted before, it's a HEB settled project, which is fairly unique. So this is settled at PG&E DLAP and is pretty favorable in terms of mitigating some of the basis risks that we look at when we talk about sort of geographic risk and P-node risk. It's expected to begin delivering energy in December of 2021. And it has full deliverability status, which means it can provide RA based off of the capacity of the project and is able to do that. Again, the project is, Solar Frontier is committed to using union labor. They have a 5-party project labor agreement already signed. They have a phase 2 interconnection study completed. They have their site lease signed, so we see this as a fairly de-risk project. Last couple bullets here are, they are committed to helping support community investments within Alameda County, as I noted before. So they are investing funds even within our county, even though the project itself is based in Tulare County. That's fairly unique. I'm not aware of any other solar developers that have been willing to make that commitment to a separate county towards where an off-taker is actually based. So we're quite excited about that. And then lastly, they've received all their necessary internal approvals to move forward with the contract. This is a little bit of an eye chart, so I won't touch on every point here, but I just wanted to highlight a little bit more of risks that we think about when we look at projects of this size. We look a lot at development and counterparty risk, the project performance risk, financial risk, basis risk, load management risk, and we've looked to mitigate all of those risks through various measures. Some of those measures are, of course, just diversification across the portfolio. So not obviously concentrating too much of our load or purchasing in any one project. We have, this is, of course, the first sort of contract we're looking to do out of both of these RFPs, but we're looking to build a portfolio of assets and limiting our contract, our concentration to any one particular developer, but also any one particular project. We also look to diversify through looking at later stage projects. We look at looking at both doing P-node exposed projects as well as hub-settled projects. So a lot of different ways that you can mitigate that risk. The last thing I'll just sort of highlight is risk mitigation, of course, is the contracting itself, right? These are fairly dense and heavily negotiated contracts. They have liquidated damages associated with delays in the project. They have damages associated with underperformance of the projects. So, and there, of course, is development security that stands behind that. So those are heavily negotiated commercial terms. We feel like the performance risk is well mitigated in that regard. And of course, as we look to build that portfolio, we do assume there will be some project fallout. There's always an assumption around certain projects, certain percentage of projects that will ultimately meet commercial operations. And we, you know, we procure with that assumption in mind so that we're not caught off guard if any one particular project falls out. Last just comments about sort of next steps here. As I noted, these are the first two contracts as part of both of these RFPs. We anticipate potentially bringing forward additional contracts related to the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative. We are, with what we're presenting here, meeting that minimum 20 megawatt target as part of the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative, but we're still in discussions about potentially other capital raising projects to bring forward. That could be in the June or July timeframe. And the other very important thing to note is that, you know, this is part of a longer process as it relates to the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative. It is a contingent joint RFP with PG&E. So we are depending on PG&E also approving and moving forward with their portion of the contract as well. And we're also assuming and relying on the CAISO approving the RMR contract cancellation and transition. And we're also relying on the CPUC ultimately approving the contract and what PG&E brings forward. So there's a lot more that needs to happen, but I think we're very excited to sort of really initiate this process with our portion of the contract, which is really an anchor to moving this whole process forward. Similarly then, with the California Renewable Energy RFP, we anticipate bringing forward a handful of contracts there as well in the June-July timeframe. So we're looking at roughly 500 megawatts of additional capacity there. And we are looking at, you know, one or multiple projects in Alameda County as well for that particular RFP. So this is just the first of, you know, many approvals that we're looking to bring forward. We're very excited to be able to look at these projects that we think are great clean energy solutions. And of course, following, you know, this particular item, you know, as we move to the board retreat, we'll be speaking more about sort of the general renewable energy topic, innovation, some of the challenges there. We recognize this is just the first step of many related to sort of contracting renewable energy. I will stop there and open up for questions.
Questions? I have a speaker. Oh, go ahead, Diane. I'm not used to looking to my right.
Sorry. I'm supposed to have a lot of room for you over there. Could you tell us what the timeline is for the peaker plant? What's the potential earliest date that it could close? And then is there a timeline for transitioning it to clean energy storage? Should we approve this contract?
So the Vistra project specifically is slated to begin delivering in January 2022. So I would consider that sort of, wow, there's still a lot that needs to
That's
happen.
A lot.
And there's always a potential for a date to push out given how many moving parts there are. You know, by the nature of that coming online, a portion of that very project right now literally needs to be decommissioned, taken off site, and replaced with batteries. So it won't be later than that. But as part of that process, you know, we're looking at, you know, roughly 3 years out where that RMR contract does need to get you know, negotiated with CAISO. And they need to really initiate sort of a project plan as to how you reliably take down the existing project and start shutting down portions of it, and sort of phase a shutdown of it, and start replacing the batteries, which obviously has a construction process as well. So I can't say definitively when that date is. What's critical here is that us initiating this contract is actually the first step to Vistra having conversations with CAISO to say, okay, we've initiated this formally. We want to talk to you about actually canceling the RMR contract that's in place. And without having a substantive commercial agreement in place that supports them from an economic standpoint to say we're going to shut down this project, they're limited in what discussions they'll actually have there.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Go ahead.
Just a couple. I know that we received an email sharing some concern about the organizations and the parent companies. Their portfolio of energy sources. In regards to the ones that responded, the 550 or so, can you speak to the makeup of those organizations? Are they all heavily vested in diverse sets of energy uses, or just a specific situation we should be concerned more about and speak to the principles of where we want to partner with those companies that are only green or creating only clean, but not in fossil. So can you speak to me a little bit about the neighborhood of the company?
Yeah, when we think about the broad portfolio of proposals that we receive and the different counterparties that are developing this project, I would say it's a fairly diverse mix. You have counterparties that are very small, some of the smallest few people within the development shop, and you have some very large corporations and organizations, some of them that are represented here today. And so I think it ran a pretty diverse mix there, and I wouldn't say that all of the counterparties represented organizations like this, like the two that we're talking about today. I think part of our evaluation process is, of course, looking at the project itself and understanding the risk and sort of execution risks associated with those. And part of it was looking at experience in building and financing projects. And I think we, based off that evaluation, I think the awarded list of projects tended to be larger organizations that have that experience and have a balance sheet to actually build and develop projects. Some of them are, you know, multi-country, sort of diversified organizations, and some of them are strictly focused on renewable energy. So I would say, for what we have looking at today and what I would anticipate bringing forward to the board in the near future, they'll run a spectrum. They'll tend to be on the larger side of organizations, given the capital that's needed for any of these projects. I will note that these particular projects are specific clean energy resources, and so while there may be some questions around what is Vistra or Shell's ultimate business model, I think by promoting clean energy resources that they can invest in and make money off of, in many ways that can also help with the transition with companies that are maybe primarily focused on fossil fuel. So I don't find that it's necessarily counterintuitive to sort of our goals and mandates, though I think it's certainly a valid question.
And if we can get sort of the vision of those organizations that they're trying to move more towards clean energy, and can further understand that what the mission of this organization is to have to procure more clean energy, I think that would be beneficial for the principles I think that were established prior to my time on this board to really move that forward and be able to support those recommendations. Whereas you might get feedback from the community like, oh, they're very heavy in coal and they're a very small element of greens, but then the argument against it before, this company would be more about they're trying and this is their vision. So I think those kind of statements would be beneficial, at least for me, to bring forth and recommend these kind of proposals.
Okay. I'll take that as feedback, certainly as we look at other projects to report as well, find some more context there and background.
Perfect. Thank you.
And the other thing I'll just note is Solar Frontier, the subsidiary division, is solely focused on solar energy. And I failed to mention that tonight we do represent one Solar Frontier America's Mark Wong, who's the VP of transactions there. Heavily a part of our discussions throughout. So.
Well, maybe you can say a few words about it, the only thing on the chair.
Okay, so. Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. So I hear the concern about, can you hear me?
Your name?
Mark Wong. I'm the Vice President of Transactions at Solar Frontier Americas. And Howard's correct. The U.S. Subsidiary is completely renewable energy. It's 100% solar. We've been selling solar modules in the U.S. for about 10 years, and about 2015, we started developing projects and building them and getting them financed in the United States. First, let me just touch on the concern about the heavy oil nature of our parent company. We're heavily invested in the United States, and all of our investments in the U.S. are renewable energy based. We've just purchased three gigawatts of renewable energy in the Midwest and in Vietnam and throughout the world. So the company is heavily focused on renewable energy at this point. It's a major mandate from the top down. We've had the CEO visit us and say that it's one of the main drivers or the core competencies that are expected of the company at this point.
Perfect, thank you very much.
And I just say this, which is why we're taking the unusual steps, to invest in the Alameda community, even though the project is located somewhere else, and doing whatever it takes to build these projects in the United States.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? Go ahead, Mr.
is correct.
Apologies for missing the beginning of the presentation, but that was an unredacted version of the contract sent to the board in a confidential packet, or how can we approve a contract that has...
It was not said. We've spoken to the terms with the ad hoc procurement committee, and that was what we anticipated was the level of kind of board discussion or review, given that there weren't sensitive terms. I think we were given some direction from council previously and the board that we wanted to avoid seeing sort of pricing and such. But happy to discuss that if we should take a different approach.
I noticed like a whole page of redactions in the indemnity, so I was curious.
Yeah, and I'll just speak to that point. You know, certain provisions we did redact that were perhaps heavily negotiated or are currently heavily negotiated with other counterparties, and since we're in active negotiations, we felt that any material commercial terms, certainly anything related to sort of dollar figures and such, were redacted in there, and the sort of the template with which we looked at was other CCAs that have gone to market, gone to boards, and sort of looked at what they redacted, and we tried to sort of be fairly consistent with that approach.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Jessica? Shall you want to slide to the right?
Do you want the podium?
I don't need the podium. That's fine.
I do need the podium because my recording over there.
Oh, yep. I see. Okay. Sure.
Sure, fine.
We're doing it this way. We're also recording you.
Jessica Bovadis, Bay Clean Power Alliance. We appreciate the proposal for Vistra, which seeks to create local clean energy, which is what we've been advocating for and what we need in our communities. However, we are concerned that Solar Frontier America project would be locking us into a 15-year contract, outsourcing the jobs and the energy wealth in another community. We really want to see East Bay Community Energy do these kind of projects and actually invest in Alameda County so that we can create those jobs, clean energy jobs that we need, as well as keeping that energy wealth in our communities. I think it's very important that we begin doing this transformation, most importantly at home and in the communities that have been robbed really of energy wealth as well as clean energy. So I'm really hoping that you would take that into consideration because you are making a decision that's locking us into a project, a 15-year long project. It really feels like they're throwing a bone into this community energy fund. It feels kind of like an offset as opposed to an investment in the community. And I really hope that you would make a decision that is best in the long term for Alameda County.
Okay, any other questions?
Go ahead. Clarifying question. Where else could we put 55 megawatts of solar in Alameda County? Will there be space?
So I think generally speaking, you know, we have performed a solar assessment as part of the Local Development Business Plan, and there are very limited opportunities to do large scale solar projects in Alameda County. There are a handful, but very limited. And then from an economic perspective, you know, the price differential between Alameda County and outside of Alameda County is quite significant, you know, 2 to 3x, you know, potentially, you know, depending on how big the project, more than that.
And one of the big drivers behind it is simply just lower quality solar radiation here in Alameda County and some other jurisdictions, so that's a big driver of sort of that value.
Thank you. How many more of these kind of contracts do you anticipate us in?
So I believe we have five.
Just
we have five more contracts sort of in this cycle that we expect to bring forward, say, this month and next month.
Is this kind of viewed as kind of getting us started? We just, capacity's not here, so we have to go somewhere else?
Yes.
Because I, in a way, agree with Jessica. The only reason why I got involved in this is I kept looking at windmill red lights every night, thinking, why isn't that power going to Alameda County? And there's a lot of opportunities here, and I disagree with you. I mean, if you look at, I think it's called the M3 Ranch off of Highway 84, there's plenty of land. You can put solar out there, and they'd probably love to do something about it and have it out there. So I'm just kind of curious, I mean, if we we approve this one, this doesn't, we can kind of move forward in the future with more Alameda County projects with the bonus direction.
Yeah, I think we will absolutely continue to evaluate and bring forward Alameda County projects, but I think it is the case that we will always, or given the, our size and quantity of renewable energy we have to buy, literally thousands of megawatts, that's, you know, thousands and thousands of acres.
There's thousands and thousands of acres out there, flat.
So, but I think that there's not the capacity, especially given the fact that we also have the imperative of maintaining cost competitiveness with PG&E, we are not gonna be able to proceed to a sort of a strategy where we say 50, 60, 70% of our renewable energy is sited in Alameda County. And I think that's, that being said, when we think about local development, there are absolutely, you know, of equal sort of dollar value opportunities for investment in a whole range, including, you know, wind and solar. Every energy efficiency investment we will make will be in Alameda County. Every electrification, building, and vehicle investment we will make will be in Alameda County. Every demand response investment we make will be in Alameda County. By definition, those have to be here. But when we think about generation, there's just not the capacity to adopt the strategy of we're going to do all of our local, all of our generation.
That's not what I'm saying. But there are areas we can do some. And I agree with Jessica that we should be looking at those opportunities and developing those concurrently.
Can I just note that in part of this being an open and competitive process was to seek proposals and projects that are existing out there, some of them earlier stage, some of them later stage. And so, you know, the evaluation here was to look at what's available, and I think what, based off the criteria that at least laid out, we selected projects that balance sort of the local needs, the job creation, as well as the financial impact. So that's what was the basis behind this. And the other thing I would just say is, in terms of land area, there is open land, of course, in Alameda County, but the other really critical piece is the interconnection related to that. And an open space isn't necessarily sufficient to say, hey, we can build solar on that. It's gotta have a path to very clear interconnection. And the interconnection is one of the most costly aspects of getting projects built.
Dan.
Thank you. So I think what you're hearing is, we're just getting started here, obviously. We have long-term contracts, and long-term contracts are what we should be doing mostly. And I think what you're hearing is, I think we all know that in the short to intermediate term, projects that we might be able to do in Alameda County are gonna be somewhat more expensive. And I think what you're hearing from the board, or most of the board, is, and we should do one anyway, and start with one, or start with two. And that we know if you have too many contracts that are too expensive, that's not gonna work. But having zero contracts nearby in the next, you know, year or more is also not gonna work for this agency. And that's why we recreated it. You know that already.
Yeah.
So I'm just reminding ourselves publicly about that. And it's very possible that kind of issuing an RFP and hoping we get something back that's local, that's worth looking into, isn't gonna be sufficient. There may be a time in the near future we have to be very kind of proactive and kind of try to put something together with various folks to create something, you know, proactively in Alameda County or really close to Alameda County. That's what it might take. And that's more work, that's harder, that's more intricate, that would be more expensive, and we should do it anyway. While understanding that most of our contracts will still be somewhere else in California, clean energy, reasonable cost, but we could always have the excuse, not excuse, the rationale, it's too expensive, too hard to do, we could always say that every time we come and go out. At some point we have to stop saying that and do something local.
So I will say in this particular procurement, if you remember, we set our minimum threshold for 20 megawatts. And so, you know, we have more contracts coming. We absolutely intend to meet or exceed that 20 megawatt threshold. We did very explicitly seek out proposals from Alameda County. It wasn't like we just said, bring everything. We actually had two tracks. We had an Alameda County track, and we had a rest of California track. We actually evaluated
Alameda County projects separately from the rest of them. So we didn't just compare Alameda County to everyone else, say, well, you're all much more expensive, so we're only gonna focus on outside. We actually we're very focused on trying to identify the best Alameda County projects that we could. And you know, given the board direction around that 20 or more megawatts, really focus on that while also building, you know, a broader portfolio of resources from outside of California, or outside of Alameda County, but in California. I'll note on Howard's point about interconnection. So one way to understand how much opportunity there is for clean energy is to look. There's actually a list. You can go online and sort of say, what is the interconnection queue? It's basically people who said, I think I want to build a solar or a wind or something. And they put their project in and then it gets studied. If you look at the queue in Alameda County, there are, I think, only a handful of large projects, so projects over 20 megawatts. I believe there's maybe only one solar project over 20 megawatts in the queue, and there are a handful of wind projects. So there really is, that supply is actually quite constrained in terms of what, you know, these are projects that, you know, are being evaluated and studied. But you know, we're working very, very diligently to bring forward, you know, one or more Alameda County projects, you know, in the coming month. One of the reasons why we wanted to make sure we included the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative project is that is a local project. It's, you know, bringing local clean energy. And in a way, when we think about really the goals of local clean energy, it's improving our local environment, right? So when you think about building solar in Alameda County, you're not necessarily going to get a direct local air quality benefit by building it in Alameda County versus building it in another county. Where you get the local air quality benefits and the real local environmental benefits is by building, you know, these kinds of energy storage projects that actually allow for reduced or, you know, total stopping of the operations of the natural gas plants that are in Alameda County. And so I think there was a very strategic approach to wanting to focus on this kind of clean energy because it delivers that local environmental benefit while also bringing the other benefits as well.
If you develop here, you get the benefit of training people how to build these facilities in the future, and therefore they become, you know, proficient. And so, how many county proposals did you look at?
I have to think back to when we received the initial RFP, but I mean, it was over 20 proposals. So some of those were very
huge. They were all not worth doing?
No. I think, as I said, we are bringing more projects over the next two meetings that we expect to bring out.
Those 20 are still in the queue.
There are projects.
They weren't losers of the RFP.
Correct. There are still projects. Yeah. I wouldn't say all 20 are in the queue, but there are projects in that.
Because, I mean, I know there's projects out there that the county's approving.
There are projects of those 20 that we are actively negotiating with.
Director
Harrison, you're way down there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's perfectly all right. That leads to a question about why you brought Solar Frontier forward first rather than bringing the entire package. If the rest of them were coming in June and July, I think it would be helpful to see the entirety, and I trust we're going to have the Alameda County content, but I would like to see them like all at the same time. So is there a particular reason why this one's running ahead of the other ones?
So I think it really is practical. We have a lot of contracts to approve.
Okay.
And so we are trying to get them forward to the board when they're ready. So our concern was to wait to bring them all, you're waiting for the last contract that's being negotiated. We did not want to risk having one contract actually push us into August when we're off, and then you're pushing yourself into September. At a certain point, these projects will no longer hold their price for you. They bid a price and say, you know, we'll take 3 months to negotiate. And at a certain point, they may say, look, we don't think this contract is going to get done. We're going to go and try to sell it to someone else. And so, you know, we have three meetings, and we intend to bring, you know, one, two, three contracts forward in each meeting between now and July.
And might that look different in future cycles because you're used to doing this contracting? Test all everything as a balance.
I actually think we will, depending on the number when you're talking about 4, 5, 6, 7 contracts, they're all going to sort of go on slightly different paths. So the goal would be to actually try to bring them together as much as possible, but likely you'll see them over the course of a couple meetings. I think our intention is always to try to do it in once because, you know, there's value in having a package, but in the end, you're negotiating with different counterparties. They, to some degree, are on their own schedules as well.
I'll just add on that we also have counterparties that are in exclusivity with us where they're not able to talk to other potential buyers. Okay. So that's why you're seeing all that time. They're willing to hold that project for you if they're in. We're actually not allowed to do that. Right? So if we extend that, if we're ready to go, but we just want to hold this for 2 months, you run the risk of counterparties saying, well, I can't just go with this. This is an asset that I need to be invested to afford.
My next question has to do with, I accept we're not going to have as much in Orange County as initially as we would like, but what are the labor agreements on these projects? Do they have project labor agreements or any other projects?
Yes, they both have project labor agreements.
Okay.
With the IDW.
Okay.
So Solar Frontier has signed five-party project labor agreement. Okay. Fisher has not, just given the maturity of their project yet, but they have contractually committed to using union labor. And they have other projects, not in Allegheny County, that they've pointed to that clearly demonstrate their commitment to using five-party PLAs.
Okay. And are you, I know you're not to talk too much about dollar numbers, but can you tell us anything about this community investment fund contribution, how much that is?
The volume I'd like to hold back now, okay. Maybe in aggregate as we look at all projects that we bring forward at a future date, we can maybe speak to that. In terms of the kind of the nature of the setup, it's fairly discretionary for the board. So it's established so that the board has discretion to sort of invest those funds as they see fit.
And help set the level as well. The board does help set the level of these investments.
You mean how, in terms of the fund itself, how we
determining how much is a reasonable community investment for an external.
No, the number of dollars, the quantity.
So the dollars are negotiated with the counterparty already.
Okay.
Right, but how to then go utilize those funds, right?
Okay, is the board involved at some level early on in determining what a reasonable return for the community fund should be from each project that might be external to the county?
So we haven't established that yet in terms of what we'll, how do we want to utilize those funds, what kind of return we see from those funds.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Well, I think your question is how much.
Yeah.
That is a commercially negotiated point as part of the power purchase agreement. So. No, that is not going to be.
You don't have like an X percent or a target.
Again, I think it's being negotiated project by project.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
So first I want to thank Director Kalb for articulating that the need to balance the in-county projects versus, you know, our financial means. I think you said it exactly right, and I just want to second basically everything you pointed out there. And I want to talk a little bit about the Vista project, because that one's pretty cool in my mind. I mean, not only are we retiring a natural gas-fired peaker plant in Alameda County, but we're doing it with battery storage, which, you know, I sort of envisioned that we would get into the storage business in a few years. I was afraid it would take us a little while to get to that point. And the fact that we're doing it now is very exciting to me. You know, I see, you all heard about the duck curve, and it's sort of an indication that our state's capacity for adding additional solar efficiently, we're sort of bumping up against that, at least some days of the year. And the way to combat that in the long term is with battery storage. Because if there are hours where we're overproducing, you charge the batteries then and then you drain them at night. And so in order to continue to build solar in the state, we need batteries. And I'm really proud of EVCE for being part of pushing that and starting that and investing in that technology. So if you don't mind, I'll move that the board approve both items, both contracts.
Don't mind.
Thank you.
Second.
Awesome. Sorry. All right, I have a motion and a second. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passes without objection. All right, with that, this board is adjourned, and we will now reconvene in a board retreat. Correct, Binder?
That's correct.
Okay, there you have it.
So I'd like to invite up Ren Orens. Ren Orens is a managing partner with E3. Energy, Environmental Economics, and we prepared a presentation on renewable energy. Talk about some of the. Do I do a break now? Okay. So we're going to do a quick 5-minute break, recognizing that we have a lot of things we want to cover. And what we can meet.
We have a person who's coming tomorrow.
Grants or a bit about those that are out right now. They're part of JP's
And we were wondering whether or not these four grants of $40,000, we haven't seen what's coming through yet, but we're wondering if they, if the, that cap of like $160,000 could be increased if more grants came out that were really worthwhile. So if we discussed that, we came up with nothing specific to add. We did talk about whether or not these future funding investments in the Oakland Clean Energy Initiative should be occurring, and somehow we did talk about these. No, we didn't have a chance to talk about the district, so we didn't hear that, so that's kind of a moot point. Looks like things are moving forward on that front. And the last thing is, we are really looking forward to getting some new members. And so we know that the there is a process going on right now that is talking with potential new members. So we're hoping that that moves quickly. And so we would love to be able to add people at least by July. I doubt we'll be able to get anybody on unless you make decisions by the 17th, which is our next meeting. But we would really like that. And just to reiterate that it's not only new applicants, but what to do with people who have rolled off but now want to continue on. That's my information for you. Thank you so much.
Any thoughts? Why are you there?
We have a call that we're organizing with the ad hoc committee, I believe next week, to evaluate
the applicants.
The applicants, and you know, I think we have no matter what, I think we have sort of two paths, but we have to ensure that there will be full continuity. One approach that is regularly taken with the boards and we take with CAC is, until such time as a new person has been appointed.
We're doing that.
Yeah. So
that way
we have, there's not going to be an issue with quorum, so we have the continuity, and then we're going to be meeting closer to the ad hoc committee imminently, but possibly have forward.
So at least by July, maybe by the 17th?
By the board meeting, right?
Right. I think
because you have to
the ad hoc group is meeting next week, we're going to try to have a phone call, and then from there, based on the direction that they give, we'll have more to report on the 17th,
okay.
The 19th.
Ed, did you want to say something?
Sure. I mean, just want to make sure, I know that the committee's met, and we had about four that we were recommending to approve. I think the CAC meeting was maybe recommending two more, so I think there may be maybe a follow-up call to confirm.
Maybe I'm confusing the topic. I was talking about the CAC appointments,
not the grants. Oh, okay, cool.
Sorry, I'm not talking. Our CAC members.
Who's on the CAC ad hoc committee? I forget who.
I think I am, but I've not gotten any inquiry about a phone call yet.
Oh, okay, well.
I'm off your
phone. Okay.
Megan?
Update. So Stephanie is out of town, and I worked with Supervisor Hagerty's scheduler. She didn't tell me who else is on the committee, though. So if you were on the committee,
I will follow up with you, Megan.
Great. Yeah. So we do have a date and time, and I will.
So Dan, you haven't heard, but your staff has been contacted.
Ah, got it.
Okay. We'll have it done by the meeting next week.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Week and a half.
All right, back to the retreat.
Okay. Quick introduction for Ren Orens. Ren Orens is a managing partner with E3, which is Energy and Environmental Economics, a firm that we utilize for a lot of our renewable energy analysis, general energy analysis. Okay. We've invited him today to come in and make a presentation about renewable energy, some of the integration challenges, capacity challenges and such. It's a fairly dense presentation, and I realize the time, so we will try to move swiftly through. But I would certainly invite the board to please interrupt with any questions, because I know some of the concepts can be fairly deep, and so we'll try to strike a right balance of depth and explanation, but realize that we don't have an endless amount of time here. So with that, I'll hand it over to you, Ren.
Thank you, Howard. First rule in making any good presentation is know your audience. I only know four or five people in this audience. So I've got a lot of material. We're not going to cover it all. ask anything that's not clear. And I'm not going to follow these slides. They're basically information that show we've done backup analysis to show you the main conclusions. What I'm going to try to do is give you kind of a brief. Done all the U.S. cases that we used in the Paris COP cases for decarbonization of pathways. We that included nuclear, included solar, it included wind, it included every technology you can imagine during those kind of cases and pathways. We've done all the Hawaii cases by island. We've done all the New York State cases. We've recently done everything in Minnesota. We're doing the Arizona cases now. So we have a bunch of common themes and lessons learned that are curated from this. Hopefully, when you're boiling it down to what you're looking at, you can borrow and leverage a lot of this information we're using. And we're working with the state on various pieces of what California is doing right now. So I just want to tell you, we're shrinking all this down because of the time. There's a big debate here about what we're doing with the power sector. And there's a difference in confusion about what 100% renewable portfolio standard is and what 100% decarbonized energy is in the power sector. And we've done lots of analysis on that, and the conclusion is 100% totally carbon-free is a heck of a lot harder than 100% RPO. And the main reason, and my credo will tell you, I confirm this, they worked together at PG&E a long time, and if you can keep the gas facilities around and use less and less gas, and use them to integrate renewables rather than jumping over the battery piece right now and doing 100% of all the batteries you need. You can decarbonize your system, use less and less gas, convert what you need of those at the end of the process, which is what we did in Hawaii. We biofueled everything left over at the end by 2045. And we didn't have to dive into a massive lithium-ion market right now that's not ready to spend a huge amount of money on because it's too expensive. You can nurture it along, pull it along, do some early cases, and expand. So I want to show you a little bit of cases, what California looks like under both of those solutions. But it's a theme here that's really important, because if you want to be able to do the other pillars of decarbonization, you need a relatively inexpensive source of decarbonized energy. It's really cool, actually, that we have the duck curve. I mean, it's cool that we have excess energy that's decarbonized at a negative price. We should be able to find some good things to be able to do with all that. What we can't do is drive the price of decarbonized energy up really high, so high that we can't decarbonize our buildings and decarbonize our cars. You know, if we do that too fast, then we're just not going to make it. We're going to get one pillar out of the three we need. And I'm going to go through a little bit of the weird stuff that's going on in California with capacity. Capacity is a very weird term. And we use it in a bizarre way in California, and we get mixed up with what battery storage does and what gas capacity provides, and a little bit of comparison of both of those. I'm going to end with, if you look at the high-level problems that are happening in every jurisdiction, all the way down from what you guys are facing to what New York is facing, Hawaii is facing, there's some common themes in this roadmap that I hope to leave you with. And Howard has a few next steps. He's going to try to build off of this into what follows and the work. Howard put together this nice little picture of saying, you know, we had this legislation called SB 100 that Brown, you know, finally signed after signing 33% renewable portfolio standards and 50% renewable portfolio standards, and then ultimately 100. And we were working with him, the legislature, the utilities, the PUC, you know, like PV, on all of these various permutations of this. But we knew it was ultimately coming. Yes, it meant a whole ton of renewables. I think the piece that got really left out in this is, one, it probably meant a bunch of storage. Two, with it, different kinds of storage, different durations. But it also meant a whole bunch of renewable integration solutions, including demand response. And you mentioned that before. There's going to need to be a ton of flexible loads in here to make all this work. In parallel, you can't just rush to do the 100% renewables without having that whole way too. I think it's one thing that's really cool about CCA is that they have the cities here who have an ability to actually work more closely with the city infrastructure to be able to deliver effective forms of what we call flexible loads. I don't want to bore you with all this. The magic thing that people fight about is 100% RPS versus 100% decarbonized is the about 7 or 8% of the difference. The way the legislation is written on RPS, it's 100% of renewables to meet the load, which is 7 or 8% less than the gen, right? Because there's losses in it. So if I can use 7 or 8% of the system, gas, well, I don't need to have all these big fancy models. They're already paid for. We bought and paid for those already. They're here. I do have a problem with keeping them. If I get rid of them, I'm going to have to jump on the battery thing too fast. So is there a way to keep the gas facilities around long enough and viable enough so this provides the flexible resource we need in the interim to be able to work when we have all the demand response we need in storage, et cetera? And that's really the key to a lot of this modeling. Any questions about this kind of big idea?
So 100% RPS includes some natural gas.
Yes.
Effectively.
And, you know, where you get in this fight is, if you give somebody a natural gas facility, does that mean they're going to burn more natural gas? And the answer to that is no. I've been doing this 35 years. Nobody just burns natural gas. It's an incremental cost. It has an opportunity cost all the time. You can burn a lot less gas in these, and if in California where we have SB 100, you're going to have to burn a lot more gas. And that's the right environmental solution if you're talking about carbon reduction. I totally get it. The natural gas plants, coal plants, have a other impact. It's important to local communities, etc. And so for that reason, you're going to want to consider replacing them anyway. In New York City, we did the whole storage roadmap for them, which is basically targeting that what we call the urban outlets, you know, with storage. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're saying that the SB 100 in the legislation itself, it said explicitly or otherwise that 100%, 100% 60 RPS, 40 greenhouse gas free, which could have been RPS, that in that for all sorts of reasons to make sure we have reliability or what have you, there's assumed a certain percentage of gas, of fossil fuel, as in the mix.
No, you can use that if you want. It's compliant with the legislation.
Okay,
there's still a debate about how much you want and where it would be and how do we do it.
But the law, as you're saying, allows that if people feel they want or need it.
Absolutely.
Got it. I understand. Okay, thank you.
So we have a bunch of economic and engineering models to look at these questions about. For example, if you read this a different way, if you read SB 100 saying 100% decarbonized, what might that look like? What might that world look like? And we were hired, I can't tell you by who, but a bunch of the big load-serving entities to look at this in the before the drafting up of SB 100. And I can tell you also, we've done it again, and we've been hired by EDF this time to look at it again, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the changes. This was done about 2 years ago, and what the key findings of that analysis were. So when we're looking at that big question, 100% decarbonized versus 100% RPS, and you run through all the things you find in this, first you find that every sector that uses and produces carbon is going to need to be transformed. And so, I don't know how many hours I spent with Governor Brown, probably 12 hours over maybe a 7-year period, going over various pieces of what needs to be done in each sector, and how he wanted a ranking of, was this easy, or was it hard, or was it hard? And the hard was red. And basically, everything in there looks hard. And so, it's hard to do all this. You know, and do it in a way that fits all the community needs as well. And we're not going to make it all the way there on time. I'm pretty sure we're not going to make it. But, you know, California's going to try. It's going to spend...
2030 or time being 2050?
No, 2050 is going to be hard to do it all. Okay. And it's not going to be because decarbonization of the power. This is easy. It can do this and spend more money and you could do it tomorrow. That's the easy part. The buildings and the cars are much harder. And California doesn't have expert buildings and cars. We've got cap and trade, but we don't have a how-to answer for it. I can tell you about some of the challenges, and that's where I'm going to end this presentation. You know, electricity sector must play a major role in this, and you've got to decarbonize that thing before you do the electrification for it in sequence. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. In all the scenarios, you get to at least 80% renewables or 80% decarbonized from power sector. In all of them, even with cap and trade everywhere. So the question really is, it's a kind of dotting the I, crossing T. Is it 80, 90, 100? Is it decarbonized, et cetera? And all the different jurisdictions are going to come to different answers on this. That doesn't stop you from moving. If you're 20 or 30 now, you're moving forward anyway and contracting incrementally like you're doing now.
When you're talking about 80% results, are you talking about gasoline, natural gas, and electricity, replacing all of those?
Or are you just talking about power sector? We're going to get to what's in the power sector, okay, versus transportation versus buildings.
Okay, thank you.
All of the cases, pretty much in the whole desert southwest, which includes most of California, so it's kind of weird. Northern California is really part of the northwest. Southern California is really electrically connected to the desert southwest a lot more. But a lot of California cases include a ton more solar. In every economic case, in every feasible case, you're going to do. So the biggest thing we're going to do is solar, which makes sense. It's great the Germans drove down the cost, first, and we're driving it down even more, and this is part of the leadership thing. And then, I mentioned this already, is if you're going to do all this, and you know all about the duck curve, you're going to need to simultaneously dive into all of these things, which are all the integration solutions, including building a bigger grid to be able to use more wind out of state, a big regional giant market. Because California by itself, big and diverse as we are, we cannot do this ourselves. It just becomes ridiculously hard. Not going from 30, 40, 50% RPS, but taking everything and electrifying it, which knocks up our loads four times. This
times.
We're going to have four times the level of electric loads we're going to have. And we're going to do it all with decarbonized resources. And we're not going to be using the great wind we have in the Pacific Northwest, potentially. We're not going to be using all the hydro and everything else and the diverse resources. So,
Brent, can you just, while you're just on that point, can you just sort of tell folks how many regional states have committed to 100%, sort of similar 100%?
So we have Hawaii did it first. California did it second, New York did it third, and then I think there are three others now.
But I'm saying more sort of, we're not going to get wind from New York, right? Yeah. It's going to be okay. In the region, but it's, Oregon,
yeah,
Washington
Oregon
State,
and Washington
New
have various versions of this.
And then Colorado.
And Nevada is talking about pieces of it now, given the Nevada blow up. But by no means, it's really the coast. So I wanted to show you a couple conclusions from this rather than going through all those. I've been going out of data for this. So these integration solutions we're talking about, which includes a whole list of different things we need to be able to do. If we have them all, we're going to be able to, and we have, think about it now, our load in California is like 50,000 megawatts. So, at 50% RPS, we're doing a bunch of electrification, moving to that, and we're already gonna have 150,000 megawatts of installed capacity from renewables. If we go to 100% RPS by itself, we go up to 250,000 megawatts just for California by itself. And if we do zero emissions, we're gonna go up and take that up about another 30%. Huge amount more reliance on storage. And the duck curve means we're throwing away about 75% on the margin of all solar we're producing, almost during every hour during the sun. That kind of heat map just looks, there are ducks all over there, huge flocks of ducks. So you need to have all the integration solutions while you're doing all that to make sense. And you probably don't do this you probably do this. Maybe at some point you decide to move forward. Maybe it's not 7%, maybe it's 5% or whatever it is. But you're really careful in kind of committing to do all this, you know, right now. You don't need to do that. Just to give you a kind of a graphic of the car problem, and we're trying to figure out how to do, basically get more cars on the road sooner, clean cars on the road sooner with the infrastructure and everything else. This is just a simple graphic of, you know, here's the cents per mile equivalent of a conventional gasoline car. And if we do 100% RPS in the future, right, in a rational way, and we have the integration solutions, and it all comes together, as we've said, really nice. It's not all going to work like it, just like the model says, right? It's going to be cheaper than the conventional gasoline, so we're going to get sometime in 2030, we're going to basically figure out 2025 to 2030, all the electric cars will start to have all this take-up, we'll start to build that load. If we don't drive up the cost of the decarbonized energy too fast. If we go right to here, this thing blows up, and nobody's going to do the car thing over here. And this 100% RPS, remember, 6 or 7%, it's almost as much carbon reduction, you know, per mile as the zero emissions full. So, you know, if you're looking at a, you know, what is the least cost way to get all the pillars down as fast as you can, it's certainly not push on all the renewables, you know, as fast as you can. You know, they're coming down. You know, do them incrementally and move along. You have the SB 100 is going to force you to move along anyway, so it's nipping right behind you anyway. But it's not really the huge value add that I see, you know, CCAs bringing. CCAs are going to bring all the other stuff that the electric utilities were never really able to make a dent in, which is on the, I think, on the transportation and on the buildings.
So what I hear you saying is sort of the implication of this is that you get 90% of the decarbonization benefit for about half of the investment cost. And that last 10%, I'm making this up a little bit, that last 10% costs just as much as the first 90%. Am I in the right ballpark there?
Yeah, when we did this, we're close. So let me give you the exact numbers. So when we did this for these big load-serving entities to present to Brown before SB 100 was signed, this is 2 years ago. These are the numbers we got. And the purple, this is the average rate in California. The purple was a 100% decarbonized case. And all the other ones were, you know, 90, 80, you know, in those ranges. They're all pretty much the same. Now, since the last 2 years, and JP, we were talking about this, storage has come way down. Good thing, right? And solar has come way down. We don't know if solar is going to stay down as long and everything else as it is, but it's come way down. So throwing away storage, you know, it's not great, but it doesn't look nearly as bad. This curve, when we just did another study, looks more like this. So it's not nearly as bad as it did look 2 years ago. Recent data looks like it's somewhere in between, but you still don't want to throw that money away because you're going to need every advantage you can on the building and the electrification side.
I have a question that sort of relates to this. Sort of, Emeryville has a company that started maybe 15 years ago called Amaris, getting yeast to make fuel. What happened? They were planning on this replacing gasoline.
Let me get to, there's a whole story about natural gas and renewable natural gas and biofuels, et cetera. Okay, let me come and then ask me after if I have an answer to that. So this is one of my favorite graphs because it's super simple and puts it all together in one place. So here's California, SB 100 compliant carbon reduction over time, right? And all of the cases that an interstate ever runs all have to comply with that line somehow, right? And what I've done is color-coded the pillars here is the stuff you all talked about, the two contracts, are the rest. So 25% renewables, 40% renewables, 74, you know, zero carbon if you get there, right? But all of these other things then, and this is the optimal timing and combination if you had control of it all, you don't, but if you could, in the perfect world, you'd be doing all this energy efficiency and you'd be doing all this electrification in buildings as you got cleaner and cleaner energy and electricity. and you'd basically be decarbonizing the power set, I mean the transportation sector along with. And only by mating those two up carefully do we even get there. So this is like threading the needle, right? You gotta do all the gen stuff, but keep it cheap. You gotta keep all the lights on with the renewable integration stuff, which means you need a bigger system that's trading effectively, right? And then you gotta find ways to, you can't force people to buy clean vehicles. This is one of those, it's not tell the utility to do it. You know, you've gotta make the infrastructure there easy to adapt and use, and you have to have all the things that are gonna, all the infrastructure required to make it make sense, right? Charging, et cetera. And same thing with buildings. You know, once you build a bad building, I'm gonna get to my next favorite slide. 100 years. Yeah, it's 100 years. And it doesn't get fixed. This idea that we can retrofit buildings easily just doesn't, right? First time costs kill you inside of buildings, right? So we've already done everything we can as a state. You know, all our new buildings, residential, are gonna be very energy and clean. But we, you know, the building stock still sits there. So we've gotta find a way to basically get the carbon out of buildings and uses. And you know, the Northern Europeans are doing heat pumps, and we're gonna end up with heat pumps too. First time costs are expensive. And we're gonna have to drive, you know, if we're gonna do something that's different from what the Germans did, we're gonna dive in, I think, on the buildings and the transportation piece. You already know about this. This is the renewable integration problem and the duck curve. Let's see. This is, I like this thing because it's like my pocket guide to all the integration solutions. And you're gonna need them. You're not gonna get big bills from the CalISO ultimately to balance your system. You're gonna need to start doing these yourself. Maybe we talked about some of these, which is when somebody, let's say you have a heat pump program, you get people in your town, city, start doing these, and your contractors start doing them, and you're training them and figuring it out, bringing the best technologies, and demoing and all that stuff, you're gonna want those to be flexible, because you're gonna want these guys to be able to not get charged for the CalISO buying a bunch of stuff for you so that they can balance their system. So in effect, you can look at it as, this is your physical head against them charging you for all the integration solutions that they would need to do if you don't do it. So self-providing all of these things, and they include, you know, differentiating your rates, sub-hourly renewable dispatch. So renewable resources, when they're not on rooftops, but even when they're on rooftops, they're dispatchable. You know, in Hawaii, every renewable resource after 2020 is going to be dispatchable. We made it a rule, you're not interconnected, none. We're done with it. They filled up all the island's flexible gen headroom, and everything's gonna basically, you can turn it on or off. Now, you can still pay the customer for making it so they don't have to pay for that, but you can buy that as a program and have it as a rate program. And if you're avoiding the CalISO charging you a bunch of stuff for not having it, then it's fine. You're lowering your cost of procurement. Mm-hmm. So that's what we call flexible or advanced demand response. You can have, when they pair storage with the stuff on their roof, you can actually use that as well. There's also an idea of, you know, flexible gas resources as a backup. I think you're gonna find out with all the new fire stuff, people are gonna be putting in a lot more backup resources. When they're putting in backup resources, I think you need to think about developing programs. They're going to have those available, particularly if they're clean. But even if they're not clean, if they are local and it's a program they have anyway, and you're in an area where it is getting interrupted, I think people are going to start being able to use those as well. And then, not so much this stuff over here. It's, energy efficiency is great. We do more energy efficiency. We need it in transportation, buildings, and power sector. But it doesn't help you much with the integration solutions, right? Because it's not, it's just, I'm reducing my load. Sometimes I actually, in the duck curve, I need more load. So it's really not an advanced form of demand response where I can increase and decrease loads based on a signal. So I said I was gonna just mention really quickly this issue about capacity and why gas is this competitive resource, we think, kind of through the end of 2030. 2030 at least, and maybe even through 2040, et cetera. And which gives you some hesitancy about how much you dive into the storage market in the short run. And it's part of also tied to why there's a current problem with the California capacity market. And I'm gonna give you kind of a kernel idea and a way to look at this. So we ran all these different cases in our models, and we see, I already told you, no matter what it is, California needs a whole bunch more solar to be compliant with that line that goes down. And in various different cases, we also need more storage. Now that storage can be demand response or bad. It doesn't really matter whether it's behind the meter or in front of the meter, right? Flexible load is the same thing as a battery, right? If I can get somebody to increase or decrease as behind their meter, that's fine too, so you can have a program like that. And we're looking here at, we have, you know, 30,000 megawatts of gas-fired resources now in California. We're trying to figure out, what do we do with these things? Because what current law says is all the load serving entities have to sign, basically, they can sign longer terms, but at the minimum they have to sign 1-year contracts to provide capacity so that there's enough available so that the CAISO, when it does all of its balancing of the system, can have enough reserves so that it doesn't run short in those markets. Well, all of these things, and so we have a peak load of 45,000 megawatts, we have a planning reserve margin, in case there's variation in that or an outage, about 15% more, so we're up here about a little bit over 50,000 megawatts of load. And when we start to put all of these things in our model, which are replacements for the gas capacity, so we put in 6,000 megawatts of renewables, 3,000 megawatts of hydro, we put in, you know, 10,000 megawatts of storage that we're doing over time and building that all up. We're importing 4,000 megawatts. We have demand response. We have other forms of capacity. We still, at the end of this thing, need about 20,000 megawatts of gas to keep this system kind of going reasonably. Now, it's true, if we lean a whole bunch more on this faster and a whole bunch more on this faster, we can knock that down, but we're not gonna be able to knock it down to nothing. And you saw it's a slippery slope on cost in doing that early. So anytime you wanna model this, it basically gets down to around, for California, 20,000 megawatts of gas facilities with less gas burn as the right kind of amount if we could choose. I don't think we're gonna be able to choose. I think we're gonna be shutting down probably more than those for a whole bunch of other good reasons. So we're probably gonna have to lean on these faster, but that would be the optimal least cost way. And it's still compliant with all of our clean energy legislation. Right?
So does all your modeling assume current technologies and approximately current costs?
We have an endless amount of learning curves, cost curves, projections, storage changes, all that. It includes every known technology thing. We're not creating new technology. We've got biofuel supply curves, which don't exist now, et cetera.
But you're assuming differences in cost based on long-term trends to continue as
and
well?
And learning curves for everything.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Is this in your 3-4x energy load scenario where energy load is growing tremendously? So it's a really important point that, you know, you're looking at going from 50,000 megawatts of capacity to 20. But there's a that's capacity without energy. So there's actually a lot less energy coming out of those plants.
That's where we get the carbon reduction, because we're burning less. You know, these things, so here's the big problem these guys are facing. When these things were built, and Mike, you can talk about this, when they were built, they were gonna run at least 30 to 40%, the peakers of the time, and make their money out of that. And the combined cycle units were gonna run 60 to 75% of the time, you know? So these things are only running now 20%, 15% of the time. They're coming up and down with the duck curve, right? Mm-hmm. So think about what you've got to pay to keep them around for your capacity. You know, these things, even though some of them are depreciated, to cover their debt coverage ratios and keep them going and all their operating costs, you're gonna have to start paying them more and more. And one of the things I wanna get to really quickly here as we're running out of time is, this is a really fuzzy picture in California. We have policy commitments to increase all of these. We have no policy commitment to keep that guy around at all. Every environmental thing is pushing to get rid of all of this, right? Including all the local communities. And so if you're sitting there in your cow pine, you know, it's really expensive to keep all this stuff going at this lower and lower and lower use rate. But if you are in this period now, you are worried kind of just about what JP said is, if these guys just start retiring, because they don't have any long-term contracts, I'm gonna get to that chart right here. So when you look at all these things, this is going too quickly. These are the uncontracted capacity in the next 10 years. These are falling off of their long-term contracts. And what you can see over here on the right is we're rapidly entering this period where, you know, we're going to have 9,000 megawatts. It's uncontracted for. And you can't wait till you have a dry winter, say, year, and no snowpack, or the year after, or the year after, we just had a meeting on the Sourdough Bill, and decide, oh, we might have a following really hot summer, third quarter, IAP blowout hours. It's going to be super expensive, and that could be your blowout market price. So one of the things that these guys are looking at is, how much do they hedge themselves, basically, on a multi-year contract? Because this is just going to get worse and worse and worse. There's no policy saving or keeping these guys around. The slides I skipped through show you everything is pushing on those other things to do more and more and more and make those things go away. And we're worried about there being a shortage and ability to buy this resource adequacy capacity that keeps this going to get required for. And then we're also worried about if these gas units go away, what happens to the energy prices that you guys do on your energy portfolio? Now, this doesn't emit, it's just a regulatory requirement. You can still do all your renewables, you can still do all your storage, your demand response, and everything else. But they're looking at how much do you hedge and what time frame. This is going to be one of the kind of go forward things you're looking at in your portfolio. This is just some local detail on things we know are retiring. And this is not meant to say run out, I think I already said that, and buy batteries. It's just to say this gas market where you can lean on gas capacity that we have, we're flush, that's going away. And this is going to get worse before it gets better. You see it getting worse and worse and worse over the next 5 years. And nothing really is stopping potential free fall in this market and price increase. We don't have a lot of time to go through all this. Some people might be saying, all right, well, our battery's going to save us from this. And we're hoping they do. And if you look at the estimates of cost of batteries, you know, they're coming down really rapidly. What's going to happen, and this is the price of what we're paying for gas now. So somewhere between 2025 and 2030, you're going to see the batteries probably will be kind of cost neutral on a net energy basis with these gas units. They're not there yet. And so you want to be able to kind of be able to work your way into a position where you can start to get some experience with these, start to close this gap, but not lean on them too heavily till later. That makes sense. Okay, I wanted to quickly get to this before we kind of wrap up. What is the state looking at, and what are other big jurisdictions looking at? And they're looking at how to bring kind of three things together: policy, technology, and what we like to call democracy and energy, which is all the choice and everything you guys are doing here, which is exercising your ability to control all this, that's happening. How do you bring it together? One of the questions is, is Newsom going to be, you know, like Schwarzenegger and Brown? This is one of my favorite pictures of Trump in the middle, and this is paradise. And you know, as far on the energy side, you know, we think Newsom is a little bit more reliant on his technology guy, much more than Brown was. But he's totally committed to the same ideas. So this pathway to decarbonization, Brown put this stake in the sand about 100% decarbonized by 2045, which is not an SB1 group. You know, you could see Newsom actually going for that 5 years from now. I don't think it's in your interest to be pushing for that, but you can actually see that coming. We've seen it, you know, before, because he's kind of made his mark somewhere on that stuff. We can also see him pushing on the cars. We can also see him pushing on the buildings as well. These are the pillars, and you should mention, yes, energy efficiency is important. Yes, electrification is really important. Low carbon fuels, and we won't get into the non-combustion GHGs. Those are all the pillars. They all put together in one of these plans, which we'll all be pushing on. And this is one of my favorite slides, just as a takeaway from this whole thing, is, so why do we, if we have till 2050, why do we need to start now? And we need to start now because you really only get these shots at things when you're replacing them. So early replacement's really hard. So when you do a new HVAC system in a building, that's when you gotta do it. And light bulbs, you know, if they're not LEDs, if they're incandescents, it was even maybe 3 or 4 years we got the turnover. So you really need to look at what are the big things that last a long time and what do I need to affect? Because once like, they put in the wrong thing, it's gonna last a long time. And there aren't just markets that are gonna cause people to change this. And forget behavior. Anything you can do, or anything utilities can do, or anything markets can do, this drives turnover and stock replacement. You know, we can't do this with carbon pricing. You know, I don't care how big the carbon price is, you don't go change out the water heater or your stove or anything else until it craps out. And so you need to really think about how long these are and what kind of incentives you need for them, and how much time you have until 2050. This is an interesting picture. Two last slides I have. Is if you look, one of the things that Howard asked me to do is say, what is the state doing to meet its goal in 2030? And it's doing something that's kind of tricky. Is when we had 33% renewables, and even when it went to 50% renewables, then we're largely doing them through the PUC program. And codes and standards, CUC, right? All of a sudden, when we ratcheted this thing up, and we're doing more through SB 100, we brought in cap and trade. You see that checkered area down there? Our cap and trade prices, you know, this cap and trade program that we invented was never really supposed to be used. It was supposed to be preempted by federal legislation a long time. So it's still sitting around. And we haven't had any growth, really. California hasn't had any big growth. You know, we're kind of flat. And so our cap and trade system hasn't resulted in any prices to do anything. But if this is really gonna happen, these cap and trade prices have to start getting, the dirty little secret about this is they have to start getting north of, they're like 20 bucks now, 10 to 20 bucks. They're gonna have to start getting to be like 100 or 120 or $140.
So then when you sort of, you know, this is your stack of various things that you need to do to reduce. And so cap and trade, but I mean, to what degree does cap and trade really a proxy for cars and build, like programs for cars and buildings?
Oh, absolutely. You know,
those are the, you can think about the pies, like that big pie, those are cars burning gasoline and building
right? Right. There are going to be less and less permits out there, so the price is going to go up, which basically will fund you guys to do programs in effect. I mean, people have to do some steel in the ground, whether it's cars or whether it's buildings or whatever efficiency that you're doing anyway. But this allows you, I mean, the good thing about this is this, in effect, funds a bunch of the building and a bunch of the car stuff and kicks in. Even, this is soon, Nick, look at this. This is 25 to 2030. And this is the first time we're actually having to dive into that back pocket and actually use that cap and trade thing that we never thought we were going to really use. So that's embedded in Mary's plan, right? And it looks even worse, you know, when we start looking at, you know, 2050, right? And like you said, how do you get it? You're going to have to get it from this thing you're squeezing down already, so this thing's going to be down to this little tiny sliver. But really, you're going to have to get it from here. It's hard to get it from here. And you're going to have to get it from there, and then even here, you're going to have to get some of those too. And figure out how to do it. That's why I said, you know, and that conversation with Brown, this is hard. This is really hard to do. I think CCAs play a really big, important role in figuring out how to do all that stuff and make it make sense available for each place in the right way. And I think, you know, your best story back to the legislature long term is, we have plans to be able to long-term participate, not only in the 2030 goals and effectively contribute, but also in the 2050 goals.
Yeah. It seems like if you're suggesting that you cap and trade the allowances for emissions, the price is going to go way up. That's going to actually make newer direct regulations more attractive.
Absolutely.
And it seems like, and those are more reliable in getting emission reductions.
Oh no, absolutely.
And so that's actually a good thing that the price is going to go up, so it gets ARB or the state or us to do more direct regulation.
Yeah, it's a bad thing politically that people supporting clean energy have been hiding that side. So if you look at all the DOE models for the US, they have this infinite supply of $30 a ton reductions. And it was all the 1,000 coal plants. There's only 500 left. 1,000 coal plants switching to gas. Well, those are all gone here. So we don't have the low-hanging fruit of the coal to gas. We're now gas to renewables with integration. And industry, transportation, and building. So we're in the high part of the tree. We don't know no longer have the low-hanging fruit in that. Howard, do you want to finish their next steps?
Yes, thank you very much. There's some additional slides here that we'll kind of breeze by. This is one that I think is really particularly interesting when you think about sort of cost effectiveness of your strategies. And so what you see is hydrogen, power to gas, biofuels, very expensive. Relative to like your carbon budget. So the Everest example that we haven't seen.
Yeah, what's happening? It should be carbon neutral yeast.
So we're dying for a cost-effective form of biofuel. There isn't one. And so if you look at the European solution to this, there are tons of deadline after 2050 form of some kind of synthetic fuel. And they're leaning heavily on this, and their backstop is, you know, CCS, basically take all the carbon, separate it out, and stick it in the ground. We fortunately have a pathway that's a lot easier. Solar, renewable integration, storage, demand response, and electrification, you know, looks like everything down here. It looks like a lot of you, and it's cheaper. Now, if the biofuel thing comes along, great. You know, Shell or Chevron or BP wants to do all that. Ultimately, we're going to need something for airplanes. There's industrial processing. So we're going to need a cheap form of fuel, you know, that is liquid that we can store. And, you know, maybe the overgen piece with negative prices plays a piece of this. But it's still R&D kind of world.
And one thing else I just want to sort of highlight, if you see sort of light, zero emission vehicles and heat pumps. So the nexus as we think about local development is those are necessarily investments we have to make in our case in Alameda. Those are all going to be done at the local level. So when we think about the real opportunity for how do CCAs differentiate themselves, transportation and building electrification is really in the end going to be the heavy lifting is going to be your transportation plan, regional transportation planning agencies. And your city, you know, your building codes
and your energy efficiency
and your planning. The CPUC, the state of California, is much less able to affect
you know, local building codes, because you can say all new construction, you know, the local governments are much more able to sort of say, yes, all new construction must do this. At point of sale, you must do this. You know, you have to install these energy efficiency measures if you sell a building. For transport, when you think about transportation, it's, you know, where do your transportation dollars get spent? That is really, those are decisions that are already happening at the local level. And so the degree to which CCAs can really partner to drive electrification, I think, is in some ways the most transformational opportunity that CCAs have to really drive this, not just deep decarbonization, but in a way that is going to be very cost effective and actually not, you know, come, you know, sort of run up against such high costs that consumers may just be on.
What is the non-combustion? What is that? What does that mean? Probably a stupid question, but I just...
Which term?
Right, the just one of the ones that's not quite yet cost effective. It says non-combustion. What does that mean?
Right.
Middle of the graph, right next to the heat pumps.
I don't know if that's a... I don't know what that is.
Okay.
We'll get back to you.
Isn't that like methane from capture?
It could be captured. But it wouldn't be here, probably. It would probably be over here if it were. So okay. It could be a standard.
We'll get clarification on that. Ren, thank you. That was impressive how you condensed all that material into a short amount of time.
Are we having a test right now?
Yeah. It's not even multiple choices. Just a couple more minutes just on sort of next steps here. So obviously there's a lot of great information there that was shared and I think was a pretty digestible manner, but there's still a lot more analysis that we need to do thinking about what is EDC's roadmap towards procuring renewables and launching programs that we're referencing that are critical to decarbonization, electrification of buildings and transportation. So just want to talk a little about next steps as it relates to our IRP. So real quick, this is just a table that sort of summarizes in this kind of light blue what the prior sort of RPS requirements were. And then, of course, in this higher number is the updated sort of SB 100 numbers just to make sure we put that in the context. And then the dotted line is what we're looking at related to SB 350, which is the long-term renewable contracting requirements. So it kind of shows you over the next 10 years, which is generally the sort of primary focus on IRP that we look at. And so we just wanted to lay out a couple bullets here as to how we think about our integrated resource planning. So in our 2018 IRP that was filed last year, really more of a compliance document, our first IRP as an organization, we stated that we maintained sort of 5% above RPS. That was some direction that we received from the board as we thought about our power content label. And we assumed sort of 85% of our RPS contracts were long-term. So a bit above the minimum 65% that's required by SB 350. We always anticipated that we would sort of revisit these targets with the board, with our broader community, just think more comprehensively of what that sort of next IRP looks like. So with our next IRP filing due in a year, what is that, in about a year, a little over a year, we've got some good runway now to really engage with the community, flesh out our analyses, and talk more with the board about some of our ambitious targets and such. So that's what this next stage is. We really want to look at some of the pathways to 100% clean energy and talk about some of the sort of programmatic things that we can launch and fold that into our IRP, which had sort of minimal focus in our prior IRP. We'll definitely do a big focus on sort of the 2020 to 2030 duration. And really look at this sort of goal here is thinking about what are the marginal costs and benefits of increased renewables within our electricity product versus some of the ways to invest in electric vehicle deployments, building electrification, things like that. So we can take a holistic approach to decarbonization. And then last point is sort of touched upon, but thinking about some of the programmatic offers that we can have fold as well.
Can I ask a quick question? In terms of analyzing the marginal costs and benefits, Do you plan to also consider non-energy benefits such as public health and components in the actual model as you analyze them?
Yes, absolutely. So I think we want to take a holistic approach to that. The prior IRP also at least touches a little bit on the criteria blues and things like that, but I think there's more robust modeling that can be incorporated into that. So yes, we do intend to take that into account. And so the last piece is just kind of lay out some key milestones here. We're looking to kick off this IRP process really very shortly here. We're going to hold multiple rounds of public engagement meetings across Alameda County, sort of that Q3, Q4 timeframe, so we'll make sure we're engaging with the public and having further dialogue, of course, with the board. And then we look at Q1, Q2 of next year. And sorry, I'm mixing up. I'm realizing our fiscal quarter versus the calendar quarter, so I'm really talking about kind of July through December of 2019 holding these public engagement meetings in the back half of this calendar year, and then presenting a draft 2020 IRP to the board in the first half of next year, so looking at sort of Q1, Q2, and submission of that would be just after sort of the mid-year in 2020. With that, that is it for the presentation.
So I guess to Nick, so can you go back that one slide back? Okay, so the last bullet there. So, and we just talked about this all the very things that we have to do collectively to reduce our emissions, be part of the overall solution. So, is your plan in terms of you're going to be staffing up over the next year or more, year and a half, 2 years? Is that staffing up that you're going to be doing, is that going to be consistent with those demand response, energy efficiency, vehicle electrification, buildings, and so on and so forth? I mean, is the broad range of things that we all acknowledge we have to do, and you just said CCA should be part of that, is your staffing up going to be consistent with being part of that?
Well, I think some of the integrated resource plan is going to help to identify the slices of emissions reductions that we want to get from each of these areas. So you'll say, all right, the integrated resource plan should tell us, we think this is where we are today and this is where we want to go in 10 years from an emissions perspective. How are we going to get there? And so clean energy is going to make up this portion of the reduction. So from a, and then, transportation, electrification is going to make up this much. And as we start to sort of identify the quantities, then we have to start thinking programmatically and say, all right, if transportation, if we're going to, if 40% of our reductions are going to come from transportation, all right, what does that actually practically mean? It means, translate that into sort of vehicle or vehicle equivalents. Okay, then how do we actually do that? Well, that's going to be, there's going to be a heavy-duty strategy. There's going to be a light-duty strategy. There's going to be a kind of a mass transit strategy. And I think as you develop the strategies, that's when you start to actually think about the staffing. Because in some cases, maybe we're focused more on enabling work that all of our cities are already doing. So you don't necessarily need it. It's more of a coordination function. Every city's thinking about fleet electrification. We don't necessarily need to be the ones who get you to electrify your fleets. We may just want to coordinate. So we hire one person coordinates the 12 jurisdictions as opposed to five people to administer a program. But I think that's more of our, probably more long-term staffing plan. In the short, immediate term, the staffing is more about getting the integrated resource plan done and really leaning on the two local development folks and then the incremental person we're going to hire who are going to help kind of define all the various strategies that we want to pursue over the course of the next 10 years.
Question? So I want to make sure I heard something at the very beginning of the presentation, which is that 100% electrification of natural gas and gasoline consumption would result in a 300 to 400% increase in electricity load? Okay. So help me get the right number in my head.
The new numbers look like it's about 20% increase in the generation portion of the bill.
Okay, so in order to replace natural gas and gasoline, we need to increase the total amount of available electricity by 20%. But
no, not the total. The cost increase in 2050 looks like it's about 20% higher than if you did 100% RPS compliant.
But he's asking terawatt hours. How many terawatt hours do we need?
How many more terawatt hours?
Is it a 20% increase in total terawatts? 50, 100, 500? What is it percent approximately?
Well, the average, basically saying, what's the average curtailment of the whole?
No, no, I think what he's saying is if you want to go from where we are today with the share of oil and natural gas, and you want to electrify all of that, how much load growth are we seeing?
You know, 100% electric cars, no natural gas in buildings, it's all electrified. What's the load increase there? It's a percentage of current load. Ballpark.
It's 3 to 4x.
Yeah.
So
it's 3x probably.
200 to 300% increase.
We're 6 terawatt hours now, we'll be 18 terawatt hours.
So, thank you. And the exact numbers is not critical, but I appreciate that because I've been thinking, all right, we're like 85%, you know, greenhouse gas free. So we just have to get that last 15%. But what I'm hearing here is no, we actually have to get 215 to 315% increase.
That's a big number at the
in clean energy in order to get to 100%, which I'm trying to absorb and think about because it really completely changes my frame of reference. And I understand now why you keep getting exasperated when I talked about this in the past and the desire to get to, you know, 100% or close. Thank you for that clarification.
We should have such a problem, as my grandmother would say.
It's a great problem.
I think that part of what you see there is the timing question, right? So, and this is, I think, what Ren was really trying to highlight is that if you do on the electricity supply side, you have to really be mindful of keeping your costs of electricity competitive, because the catalyst for people to switch to EV are going to be, oh, yeah, it's a good car, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, but it's also less expensive. Like fuel, my electricity fuel is less expensive or as expensive as fueling it with gasoline. Or in the home, it's my heating bill isn't twice as high now that I have an electric heat pump as opposed to a furnace or my, and that's really the thing, the balance that is so critical as we start to think about transitioning to these new electric-based technologies. We have to be really mindful of fuel cost parity. And that's, you know, I think that's what this slide is really about, is fuel cost parity. We can't just say, well, you know, gas is $4 a gallon, but electricity is $6 a gallon equivalent cost. It slows adoption. And that's when you can say it's $3 equivalent, that actually becomes a major accelerator of adoption. And there's a virtuous cycle, because as you have more adoption, that's what's driving your emissions reductions. But in our case, it's also helping our local, you know, public health crisis, which is mostly driven by criteria pollution. It's combustion of gasoline or diesel in cars and trucks. And as you drive that more electrification there, it actually creates this additional positive benefit around your public health.
And one point I would just touch on there is, as you know, Nick, the new fuel stock, electricity, needs to be as cheap or cheaper. It really is cheaper, right? Because there's an existing housing stock, and so if you're going to go do a retrofit or an installation of some sort, there's a cost associated with that. So really it has to be cheaper than the, you know, sort of existing fuel stock. And this is just something we didn't really touch on, but I thought it was interesting as you think about the different types of equipment that you might change, sort of the life of it, and I think the number of replacements they have over time. When you look at buildings, of course, very long life. You don't get an opportunity to replace that, right? EVs, you do, though, when you look at the scale of different types of installations, you know, in some cases you have, you know, you have sort of two replacements over the course of sort of 35, 40 years.
So I have a quick question for Ren, and you may or may not know this, is whether or not you've done any analysis about the cost of the raw materials for vehicle batteries and storage batteries and where that raw material is actually located to understand if it's even, you know, kind of what the ramifications are going to be for us trying to move all these vehicles and storage into these batteries. Is there enough?
Yeah, I think, yes, the answer, short answer is yes, we've done life cycle analysis and a full scale analysis. We're not really optimistic that lithium is going to be the ultimate choice for long duration storage for the power system. You know, lithium is dense, it's getting really cheap, but it's not really long duration storage. So we need something that's cheaper, not as dense. We've got land, et cetera, we don't need to carry it around. And so whether this is a flow battery or whether it's some saltwater battery, we don't know.
But like there's a lot of lithium in California, actually. The lithium reserves in the Imperial Valley are some of the best in the world. So there is some work to try to figure out if that can be developed here to create a storage industry here. Commissioner Hochschild, who's the president of the CEC, is working on that with Connecticut right now.
So this has been really, really helpful for me to understand context. I'm pretty new at this, so I can use. Can you do it one more time?
yeah, right.
It's recorded, so yes.
Okay. but even with this, I found it dense. And what I'm thinking about is how to communicate this to my constituents who, you know, I'm looking at the strong industry trends, the policy, technology, and democracy, and when, you know, the democracy is how do you get people to buy into this? So, it's, you know, so yes, part of it is let's make it cheaper, but part of it is, you know, if you keep it the same, and you can make the case that, oh, we're not actually all going to die by 2050, which is... I've been feeling a little depressed about that. You know, so this is actually, I actually find this to be both explanatory and you know, helpful in understanding it and giving me a path forward to understand where we're going. So part of it's about EBCE, part of it's about how I understand it. Is it possible to take the show on the road? I see you've got some community meetings coming forward. I'm talking about something that is just, you know, the simple version of this that we can start taking to our cities right now.
I think what I had anticipated is that the IRP planning process and sort of the public engagement that you referenced, we'd probably do some short form version of this to educate. That may be a little different than what you're envisioning, which is what can we do right now to sort of...
What I'm talking about is taking what we saw right now, mm-hmm. making it something that is... Here's what we're looking at, because that way we're getting, I just think it's critical for getting more buy-in and more understanding of what the context is. So the idea, I mean, this was totally new to me that, oh wait, maybe we're not going for 100% right away. We're going, you know, that 6-7%, we might not want to go there immediately for many reasons that you explained. That doesn't have to wait until we get to the community engagement.
Yeah, I think that's great feedback. I mean, I think we should take that back and think about what's the best way to patch this up really quickly and efficiently sort of get it out and work with some of our local jurisdictions mm-hmm. in getting that message across. And I certainly welcome mm-hmm. board members to help us think about avenues for that communication and channels where we can help make that presentation, maybe create some form of a webinar or a video to put out there. Mm-hmm. So definitely different ways to go communicate this information in a fairly efficient manner, but we'll definitely take that back and think about that.
Totally agree with that, but we really are going to need to have to dumb it down. Not to be too rude about it, but to simplify it. Because I missed a lot of what you said, and I'm pretty good at keeping up with this stuff. I'm pretty knowledgeable about this. To expect members of the public to be able to follow even 10% of that is just unrealistic. And so, got to figure out some way to.
Community Energy Choice for Dummies, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's not going to be easy, but if we can do it, then I'd say, yeah, let's shout it from the mountaintops.
Speaking of members of the public, many of those people are here today. And so this is, you know, a retreat, so it's a little more free-flowing. So if anybody has a question or comment, stand up, say your name, and present the question or comment. Now it's time.
Hi, I have a question, actually, Jada.
And what's your name?
Jada. Yep. Local Clean Energy Alliance. So I have a question for Ren. Is your model based on keeping centralized, top-down power grid, have you considered other like grid designs?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, just stand up.
Yes, part of our, I mean, you saw in Hawaii in particular, there just isn't enough land. And we can't do offshore wind because the Pacific Fleet won't let you do it because the nuclear subs are right, they're coming in and out of there. So basically, we're going to need about a third of the energy coming from rooftops. So they're all behind the meter. So there's a demand response whole tariff designed to encourage the right amount of demand response energy. But you know what you find in all the mainland cases is, you know, unless you have a really high land value, which you do in New York City or Los Angeles or something else, you know, areas where you have a lot of land, you're finding land to be able to reuse and it's cheaper than rooftops.
Thank you.
Wouldn't low-hanging fruit also include a change of the rules for our state where you could throw your generated power across to your neighbor? And you know, this isn't allowed right now, but we could, as a state, loosen up a little bit and let, you know, the transmission charge, the grid charge is 20%. That's 20% of low-hanging fruit for a certain low level of production. And, you know, why are people talking about that?
Yeah, there's a big debate about whether big grid and little grids can live together. You know, little grid being basically microgrid, community energy, et cetera. And, you know, the answer, you know, when I'm asked that, I say, absolutely, they can be harmonized. There are cost-effective applications of microgrids, right? Where you're using the big grid to back up the little grid and they're supportive, right, and symbiotic. But, you know, I think what you don't want to do is, so I'm also doing, there's a very rich person who lives in the Bay Area who owns an island in the Pacific. And I can't say the person or
can
the island,
donate to
but
us?
There are two big giant hotels on this exclusive island. And his idea of, and he sits on the board of Tesla. So his idea is, let me take my two big hotels and just take them off of the grid. And the 400 people who live on the island can be left with the dirty system, and then the costs are going to skyrocket by themselves. So I don't think you want to let this person
opt out of the pool, right?
No, but I also don't want to let rich people who have access to more capital opt out of the pool. So it's exactly like healthcare, right? Healthcare is cheaper if we have a pool. There is a symbiotic way to provide pool and self-supply together and make them harmonized, but you don't want to allow just people to exit whenever they can without paying for their part of the system.
Anybody else? Yes?
Barbara Stebbins. I have a couple comments. One, I'd really be curious to see how all of this might change if you factor in predictions for worsening climate conditions over, you know, a very short term, as we have begun to experience here in California in a very graphic and real organic way. And then the other thing I wanted to say is, in terms of getting public to understand and buy in, that honestly, if you bring it local, if you talk about decentralized systems where they can think about what their communities might look like, if in fact they had clean energy resources, if in fact they had electrified buses that were running on time regularly that they could access, you will get a lot more buy-in. They will understand a lot more of what you're talking about if you bring it home and make it really more meaningful in their lives.
Thank you. Anybody want to comment on that?
I think that point about sort of the integration of all the things that have to happen is right on, right? I mean, that's why I think when we talk about this integrated resource plan, it's not just thinking about, you know, in some ways it's the merging of a lot of the concepts in the local development business plan with all of the kind of wholesale procurement that's occurring. And so it's that connection between all of the building the
buying the electric buses and building all the charging that's needed and thinking about all the transformation and the way goods movement occurs and electrifying trucks and thinking about that in connection with, in some ways, these long, big contracts that we're signing, right? So you, and I think that to some degree is the conversation that we want to have is we have to transform the local community through electrification, and that is what is going to deliver huge benefits, huge economic benefits in, it's lower cost to operate, so people are saving money every day. Instead of pumping $4 gas in your car, you're fueling your, you're fueling your car for $2 equivalent with electricity, or you're riding an electric, a new electric bus that is lower cost to operate, so they can have two buses instead of one old dirty diesel bus. And that is the community transformation that has to occur. And that's, I think, when we think about how do we communicate it, it's really merging those two and sort of articulating a vision for what, how many cars do you have to switch? How many buildings do we have to transition? And putting it in numbers that people understand. People understand, if you do this, it's worth planting a million trees or taking a million cars off the road. I think it's trying to identify easy to understand metrics. And then thinking about it, when you're taking those cars, you're electrifying, how many jobs are you creating? Because you're creating a huge amount of jobs when you electrify. And they have to be in our community because the electrification is happening. We're not going to go and electrify Contra Costa County. We're going to electrify Alameda County. And that there's a huge economic development opportunity associated with that.
I think that sort of speaks to the, it's a both and, not an either or. If you understand, this sort of is the, here's the overarching context for how this all takes place, and then here are the effects on the community when this takes place. And those two things go together, and being able to make them go together, I think people do better when they see the concrete ramifications. And they understand how that fits in with a larger context.
But Ren, I did ask a question about climate change and the effect on projections. Ren, do you want us maybe speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to translate this into something really simple, you start out usually with. So you have an audience who knows nothing about any of this.
Oh, Ren, I think the question she was asking more is about as the climate is changing. It's getting hotter, we have less water.
Oh,
and how does that affect sort of your projections around what we need to do?
Yeah, the water case is really interesting because, the West really depends on a lot of water for balancing. And so it really, when you basically get rid of all the hydro that we use, because we just don't have more of it, especially California only has 5,000 megawatts. The Northwest probably has enough for themselves, but they're not gonna be selling us all the stuff. And so we're going to basically, this makes that whole gas and the battery transition and the demand response and the big giant markets. It's what's weird, Nick, is you're talking about all this local stuff, but we need huge markets to help us on the wholesale side. So we need that wind from Wyoming, the great wind from Wyoming. And we need all the solar from all the desert Southwest if we're 3x or 4x times the whole thing. And we need to trade all of our excesses. I'll give you my excess solar, you give me your excess wind, and we fit them all together in the same system. So that's why I said those challenges are really big. They're big on an institutional basis, they're big on a governance basis, and they all have to fit together and make this work.
I think, so one element of that is just thinking about the seasonality of our resources. So in the summer, we have a lot of sun, and we also have a lot of wind. In winter, we have less sun and we actually have less wind, right? So we don't have really hot days in the Central Valley dragging a lot of wind through the Pacific Range and creating a lot of wind resources. There's lots of wind resources that are blowing at different times of the year in accessible markets. So there's kind of daily load that we deal with in demand response, but you can't do demand response or batteries that take you from summer to winter. So that's an option for looking at it. Larger picture, because the Southwest has lots of sun all year round. So there's a lot of bigger things even that we haven't covered here from a seasonality perspective that need to have an LSE be contended with.
Seasonal DR.
Just turn off your heater for the next 3 months.
That's where you need a biofuel.
Any more comments or questions? Yes, go on.
Yeah, I have a question also for you. Excuse me. This particular graph, which talked about the 100% RPS and the challenge of going to
directly
zero emissions, the sort of the short-term, near-term impact. I'm curious about how that graph would look if instead of 100% RPS, if it was what I'll just say is greenhouse gas free. So sort of the brilliant 100 example of large hydro and renewables. What does that do to that graph? Because I can understand how this really causes a problem for electrification of transportation.
Nate, do you want to answer that?
I think this is a hard one to compare to our products, because this has that sort of 7 to 8% gas, and this is a truly zero. So in a way, you could argue this is brilliant 100. But the difference of where we are today, this is a scenario we're looking at. This is 2045.
Yeah.
So this is a long way in the future. Right today, whether you're East Bay Community Energy, any CCA, any utility, if you have rooftop solar and you generate more than you use, there are still 40, 50, 60, 70% of the hours where you're not physically using 100%. This, I think, is premised on the idea that you're physically, 100% of your hours are being served by renewable energy, or in this case it would be 92% of your hours are physically being served by renewable energy. In this case, it's 100% of your hours. Today, when we talk about 100% renewables or 100% carbon free, we're not talking about this sort of hourly view of decarbonization. So what that means is, when one or two or three CCAs or that are saying they're 100%, you can say that if you're not doing it on an hourly basis, because there's enough other ones who are not. But if we're all saying we're 100%, it's not possible, right? That's why actually the buildup on the, talking about electrification, it's why it's actually so important to, yes, you want to have very clean electricity, but you really need to build up all those balancing resources. It's energy storage, it's demand response, it's vehicles, it's buildings that use electricity, because you need to build those up so that they're able to sort of say, okay, it's really sunny out, the building is gonna essentially store energy by air cooling when it's sunny so that it holds through into the evening, so you don't have to cool the building in the evening. Or we've come up with, we're storing it in hydrogen and, that's being piped. But I think that's really the challenge today when we talk about 100%. And, I think sometimes, so I've had conversations with members of our board and certainly members of the public about 100%. And why do I have some caution about really just being really focused on getting to 100%? Because when you think about our carbon picture, we could be 100%, but physically, we're not.
Yeah.
We're actually quite a ways away from physically being at 100%. So let's focus on a clean supply. Let's, keep incrementally increasing the amount. Let's keep building new wind, new solar, new clean energy resources, while really focusing our effort on transforming the way we use energy sort of across our economy, across our community. And that really is in the transportation and the building space. And I think, again, to my point, we at SCC are uniquely positioned to do it because we can partner with our building departments, we can partner with our transportation agencies to really say, all right, we want to make sure at a certain point, any new construction, commercial, residential, any one of our 12 communities has to be all electric. That's transformational in terms of our built environment. Getting back to that, how many times do things get replaced?
When we think about cities and the fleets, they have probably, among our 12 cities, we probably have tens of thousands of cars that are owned by our 12 cities. How do we work with them to like supercharge the adoption of electric vehicles across our city? So that changeover is happening much more quickly, while also creating opportunities for all of our residents, not just those that can afford a new car, to be able to benefit from electric transportation opportunities. So that's, you know, mass transit, that's micro mobility, that's cars, and then really focusing on, you know, our heavy duty segment. You know, to say like we have a lot of trucks that stop at the port, drive up and down the 80 corridor, up and over, 680 to the 5. How do we actually start to transform that segment as well? And I think that's where the communication challenges, because it's actually a much bigger challenge than going to 100%. But that's frankly what I think we all want to do. That's why we're here in the room today, is that we want to transform our economy to one that is very low carbon. And frankly, that's the lessons that we can export. We think about exporting the CCA model. It's not just exporting, oh, we're 100% clean energy. It's exporting this economic transformation that's happening across multiple segments.
Okay, I think it's past our time to call it a night. So thank you all for being here. We all have a lot more work to do, obviously for the next months, years, and decades ahead. And thank you to staff for doing all this, and we'll see you soon.
How?
Yeah.
Non-combustibles is like material things that are made of fossil fuels. So like materials, plastics, asphalt, butane, things like that. That's a non-combustible fossil fuel. So materials we use.
Greenhouse gases that aren't being burned.
Fueled, yeah.
That could be agriculture too.
Yeah, fertilizers,
I mean,
things.
You know, mission and vision. I'm not sure we present it as pillars, but I can't remember what it says on our website or what they do.
Yes. Right.